Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, which is the SGG of this terribly named podcast series, but the QA, that's the important part, the question and answer. We like to kind of chew through tech news stories. We like to follow up on stories as they evolve over time. And it's why I like to hold my podcast on a Monday, even when it's a holiday weekend. If you're in the United States and if you're United States persuasion, then happy Labor Day. I hope you're out there having some fun with friends and celebrating your weekends and your rights and your work weeks that were all given to you. Thanks. Organized labor unions. So like, oh, I love having a weekend off where we should actually be talking about a 4-day work week. So, especially for this being in the Monday morning, we have to keep this show a little bit more on the rails than what I would normally do. We are going to go hang out with some friends. We've got some party subs on the way. And I still want to be able to chat with all of my online buddies like Ron Guido and Barry Johnson and Coppa Cash and Lampros and Dave Burns and Scoop and Barry Johnson. We got a good crew in here. We're just going to chew through some of the news that's been happening over the last week. Juan's going to ramble and rant about AR glasses, as I am wont to do. We've got a bit that we can kind of chew on. We can chew into. I keep making up amalgamations and mashups of other phrases. So I hope everybody had a lovely week and a lovely weekend. And like I said, if you're in the United States, this is one more day of the weekend. Hey, Fat Produce! So unfortunately, Fat Produce was just on the Nomad Tech Project. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to hang out in the chat. So I'm really sorry, Andrew. I was really wanting to like type out more what was going on in the chat. But every time I would kind of get settled in and focus on my screen, my daughter would come over and be like, "Hey, Dad, do you want to help me build a robot?" And so then we built like this little Tinker Crate robot, and she shot a video of it. She wanted to show her grandmother. She shot a video of it. She edited the video, so she trimmed the head and tail. She asked me for help because she wanted it to fade in and fade out at the end. And then she picked a soundtrack
for her narrated video showing her grandmother her new Tinker Toy robot. And anyone want to take a guess what song a 7-year-old picked for a robot video to show her grandmother? I'm going to take a quick sip of coffee here. Give me some song titles. What do you think a 7-year-old picked as the backbeat for a robot video? I'm just going to slurp on some coffee here for just a sec. Ooh, Fat Produced almost nailed it. So Dave Burns and Fat Produce both went to Daft Punk. So my daughter, being my daughter, and loving good little sort of puns in her production. So both Dave Burns and Fat Produce both pointed to Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger. I don't actually know the title of that song. I just know it's some combination of those four words. You two were so close. My daughter picked Robot Rock. Bam, 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 bam. So that's about as much as I can hum it right now. I actually, this entire podcast just got, you know, taken down by a DMCA request. Dave Burns just not raining tacos. yeah, so I'm sorry, Andrew. It's when your daughter is like, hey, I want to try and do some engineering. And so the cool thing was she was actually like doing like the little wiring, and she figured out that if she reversed the wiring on the motor, it caused the robot to walk backwards. It was really cool. Bionic Scoop, Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger is correct. Okay, well, thank you. I've already forgotten, even with your comment being right there in front of me, I've already forgotten the order of those four words. So, Andrew, I'm sorry, I'm going to be part of the replay crew for Nomad Tech Project, but I'm going to be listening to that today, where we're visiting with some friends is a bit of a longer drive. So, we've got a lot of tech news to kind of cover. We're back on. So last week, apologies to anyone on the replay crew or who, especially folks who were listening to the audio version of the podcast. I was in bad shape. I've just like these like swings, highs and lows of like getting a ton of work done and then kind of hitting some like manic and then depressive states. And last week was our pajama podcast where it's already a very casual, kind of off the cuff, very low key, not as structured kind of show. And I really woke up that morning thinking, like, yeah, I need just some play time. Even though we still talked a little bit about some of the stories and stuff, the chat was still active. I needed to just jam on some Tetris. So last week was maybe one of the worst audio podcasts I've ever produced. And I still put it out as an audio podcast. It sounds terrible. Because, like, in between me just losing my train of thought because I'm actually paying attention to the Tetris board, you can also hear, like, the little controller clicks and stuff like that. It's real bad podcasting, but thank you everybody who dropped by last week. This week, we're back on schedule. We've got a news block and a gadget block, and I want to start us off with some housekeeping here. Here, let me get that out of the way. Gormlord. Gormlord is apparently a phenomenal Tetris player. So he was given, Gormlord was giving me a run for my money, pretty hardcore. I actually had to, like, you know, you can kind of play some Tetris and just have some fun. Like, I actually had to, like, play. So that was really exciting. I love it when I get a good challenge. Because I've been playing Tetris since Tetris was invented. And it's just been one of those games that kind of keeps coming into my life. And then, you know, maybe I'll settle down, let it kind of rest for a bit. And then a new version of Tetris will pop up. It's just this... It's been this presence in my life. So it's always fun to meet other people that can kind of play... Because again, I'm not great. Like if you watch like a Jay Estrus tournament, I am not at that tier. But I can. There were a new series of challenges that just went up on Tetris Effect, and so I started doing some of the playlist challenges, and I'm S tiering all of them on my first try. So I'm at that level. I'm at that level where I am competent on a controller to play on Tetris Effect, which is like the most mellow version of Tetris that you can find. So, Gormlord, that was super fun. Thank you to everybody who showed up. But then also that for a couple of those rounds, Gormlord kind of kicked my rear. So, we've got housekeeping that we need to dig into, and I actually have quite a bit to talk about, but some of it is currently Patreon, just because I knew we were going through a holiday weekend, so my timing on some of these articles is a little weird. So, currently, from last week on SomeGadgetGuy.com, I finally got that Behr Dynamic Bluebird ANC review out for folks who are looking for a new neckband. This one is a very exciting addition to the world of Bluetooth earbuds. Behr Dynamic makes some of my favorite true wireless. The Freebird are some of the longest lasting. The battery life is incredible. So if you move that battery to a neckband, it improves the battery life on a single charge even more. And someone please correct me down in the comments. I could not find another good example of this. The Behr Dynamic Bluebird are the only neckbands that I've found that have a dedicated USB audio mode. So not only do they have multi-point, you can connect two devices over Bluetooth, you can also plug a cable directly in, and a USB-C cable, and then it just shows up as an audio device for your computer or laptop, or game console, like I was playing on my Steam Deck. Plug a cable in, the Steam Deck is also trickle charging your earbuds, and it's a direct cabled, no latency solution. So someone please, if there is another earbud neckband that can do that, let me know, because I'd really love to take those for a spin. Moving right along. The other, I don't do mailbag posts as often as I should, but this one was just kind of fun because I got a comment on the Mastodons from someone, and I believe they were calling me a huckster. This is a quote I got on Mastodon. I'm kind of disgusted by the hucksters pushing these as AR glasses. Anyone buying these simple video glasses expecting AR capabilities is going to be pretty angry at the company and the social media accounts pushing them. I can only assume that this company is trying to grab as much money as possible before the bottom drops out and they disappear with the cash. So, I mean, normally that kind of tone, I would get a little defensive and argumentative, but it was actually, to me, kind of a wonderful opportunity. This one is like, we need to kind of break this stuff down because I think consumers have an incredibly inaccurate depiction of what augmented reality is, what it can be, what it should be, and what our tech capabilities are today. So even though I'm pretty sure that person was insulting me. I took some time. There's a full response. Like I wrote out, and it's not just me calling this person a dummy, but there's a full response. And then that goes hand in hand with a preview that is currently up on the Patreon. And so that response that I had, we've got to kind of define what augmented reality is. I'm crafting another long form essay, and this one I think needs to be a video, but I'll probably also put out all of this as like an audio podcast version too. It's not going to be as long as my Samsung hater podcast. But the title I'm working with right now, The Decade We've Lost Waiting for Apple Augmented Reality. And it's 4,000 words. So that's a goodly amount of content just talking about the hype machine. And I'm not actually blaming Apple on this one. Normally, I point to Apple marketing as the reality-distorting entity. Like, Apple misrepresents their own products and manages to always make their competitors look like garbage. And that's not really the point of this. What I'm upset by is the cottage industry of Apple fans posing as journalists that promote Apple at the expense of everybody else, and then set up completely unrealistic expectations. So it's not even, like, I'm not even upset about Apple on this one. I'm upset about all of the tech commentators that convince people that there's only going to be one preferable average consumer daily driver solution. And so this is, to me, a very toxic element of the tech conversation that we run into. If you've been listening to these types of tech editorialists and tech journalists and commentators, basically Apple fans posing as learned, unbiased tech reviewers, you would have missed out on literally 17 years of amazing, fun face computing experiences that you probably would have liked. But all this while, they've been telling people, don't buy this, don't buy that, it's too rough, it's too unpolished, it's too expensive. And then Apple finally puts out their first version of a mixed reality headset, and it addresses nothing that these people have been hyping for 17 years. So that's going to be a very brutal video to put together. Just getting all the pieces together. I think I'm going to kind of rip off the tone of Cold Fusion. My opening line is, "Welcome to another episode of Hot Fishin." So I'm hoping to have a little fun with it, but it is going to be a longer form video essay. And then just some other quick housekeeping notes. We can kind of wrap this up here. Here we go. I wrote up just a brief editorial talking about the Xperia 5 Mark V, but we're also going to save that for the second half of this podcast in the gadget block. We're going to chat about some of the concerns about Sony's distribution for this year. And then I also just put out a quick little review. This will go public on SomeGadgetGuide.com, just a written review on a handy little battery, viewed a little through the context of Marie and I recently prepping for a tropical storm that rolled up through Southern California. So that's a monoprice 20,000 milliamp hour power bank. At some point, we just start talking about amp hours, right? Does it, at some point, doesn't that make sense? We could just say it's a 20 amp hour battery instead of a 20,000 milliamp hour battery. I don't know. Who wants to join me on reducing some of the zeros? I mean, just think about the fractions of a penny worth of ink that goes into the packaging on every one of these batteries. We could save those companies literally dollars of ink. Yeah? Yeah? Anyone? It's the worst. All right. JG Wright, but more zeros. Dave Burns, bigger number is better. I'm in marketing. I should know. Have you guys been getting those terrible Google recommended articles? I review cars for a living, and here's the top 17 things you need to know about your next sedan number 8 will blow your mind. Like, I love these, like, in the title of the article, the appeal to some kind of authority that I do this for a living. And then you read the article and you're like, there was no insight in what you know. This was a waste of everybody's time. I start getting, like, was it Happy Madison? Like, thank you for making everyone in this room dumber for you having contributed to this conversation. So we got to do a quick J-Man150 gifted a tier one sub to my buddy Andrew, Fat Produce. Thank you so much for supporting the show, J-Man150. You've been incredibly generous over the last couple podcasts, and I really do appreciate it. At some point, what is the current lead time? We're estimating that I will get an actual soundboard in 2033, so that when someone does something awesome like supporting the podcast, I can just push a button, and then you hear wah-bah-bah-bah-bah instead of me saying it. I feel like that's a reasonable lead time for me to catch up to the high-tech world of Twitch streaming that was accessible like 5 years ago. So, Dave Burns, I'll be retired. Okay, so that's the race. I have to get a soundboard before Dave Burns retires from the job market. So that's what I apparently have to try and do. And Rico Man, subscribe to Tier 1, subscribe for 23 months. Next month is 2 years. Rico Man, thank you so much for supporting the show. Wow. Bow, 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 bow. All right. Everything that we're going to be talking about this week, all of the housekeeping, all of the show notes, and of course, all of the actual articles and links, everything's going to be linked on this week's post on SomeGadgetGuy.com. You can catch all of these links, and I hope you do. I know we kind of blitzed through sort of what the headline and some of the articles talk about. And I know part of this is that I like to try and follow up on these stories over time. So especially if there's something like net neutrality related, we like to sort of see how does this news evolve over time. But I'm never trying to subvert the article or subvert the journalism. And especially for some of these outlets that are doing incredible work, we've got two articles this week from Ars Technica. I'm a big fan of some of the journalistic reporting. Whether or not I always go through all of their reviews, that's another thing. But the actual tech politics, this is the kind of stuff that we really need to sort of stay informed on because it changes so quickly. And I also feel like our current legal system and lawmakers are woefully unprepared for being able to catch up on any of this. So, starting off, it's no surprise that if there is an FCC story in the news that I like to cover it. And that means that none other than Mr. John Brodkin over at Ars Technica will be making an appearance on this week's podcast, as I have a huge crush on John Brodkin. I think he does incredible work. From Ars Technica, FCC says, quote, too bad to ISPs complaining that listing every fee is too hard. Comcast and other ISPs asked the FCC to ditch listing every fee rule. FCC says no. Five major trade groups representing U.S. broadband providers petitioned the FCC in January to scrap the requirement before it takes effect. In June, Comcast told the FCC that the listing every fee rule, quote, imposes significant administrative burdens and unnecessary complexity in complying with the broadband label requirements, end quote. The five trade groups kept the pressure earlier this month in a meeting with FCC officials and in a filing that complained that listing every fee is too hard. The FCC refused to bend, announcing yesterday that the rules will take effect without major changes. Quote, every consumer needs transparent information when making decisions about what internet service offering makes the most sense for their family or household. No one wants to be hit with charges they didn't ask for or they did not expect, FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel said. This one is super low-hanging fruit for an FCC that I believe is still in deadlock. It's one of the few things that they've been able to agree on across party lines that it's real dumb that they can charge you money for things and not tell you what they're charging you for. That's an FTC issue, and it's an FCC issue. And of course, the lobbyist groups on all of these ISPs, all of these internet service providers, they're trying to fight the most basic disclosure. Literally just, you gotta put in your bill what you charged the people for. It'd be like going to a supermarket and buying your groceries and getting your receipt, and it just shows you the total. Oh, but it's too hard to list out all of the other things that you bought. who could even read all that? It's just so hard. You would be upset if you saw all of the little things that we added in there. I mean, it's inflation. It's probably inflation. That's the big problem. JJ, price transparency is kind of a big deal. In fact, our entire like capitalistic society is sort of built on this idea that you give money for goods and services. Apparently, the people who run Comcast had a problem where that was it's a bridge too far. They weren't able to kind of grok. Oh. Right, we're charging the money for all this stuff. While we're also getting kickbacks and we're also getting tax deals and tax breaks and sweetheart zoning deals, like we're getting all this money from the federal government, from taxpayers, and we're charging customers a whole bunch for our services and we're putting on unnecessary caps and throttling measures and stuff like that. But oh, it's so hard to tell people what they're buying. It'd be nice if we had, like, some actual regulatory power in this space. It'd be pretty sweet. Dave Burns. I mean, the prevailing opinion of our lawmakers on governing is if we wait long enough, everyone will forget that we're not actually doing our jobs. And Fat Produce, completely agree. ISPs are scummy pieces of filth. Dave Burns, again. Oh, I just pinned it. I didn't mean to pin it. Sorry, it was a great comment. I just didn't mean to pin it. ISPs, scummy pieces of filth. Dave Burns, it's hard to be criminals when we have to be seen. JMX Warrior, too hard to list it. I hate the American ISPs for you. Yeah, JJ, no, I'm definitely bringing up capitalism as a sort of the mocking definition of capitalism. JJ says, I argue we are in an increasingly centralized cronyist economy, but I digress. So, I also have to do my hilarious soundboard. Fat Produce just got real generous, gifting tier one subs to JMX Warrior, Otaku 2X, 2 Turbo, KMK Zero, and Gormlord. Andrew, what are you doing, man? Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. That's really awesome. I think that's pretty great. Yeah. And again, for people that have been showing up and names that I'm recognizing, I appreciate the support. And also just, again, my Mondays are just made so much nicer, and it's so much more fun to hang out with you geeks and chat about all this stuff. So let's keep chewing through the news block. Let's keep moving right along, get that out of the way, and cue this up now. Okay. I'm about to get a little nerdy. I have gotten some feedback from some people who like to tune into parts of my podcast, and I really don't have a great solution for this, and I just have to apologize. As I learn more about things like advanced chip fabrication, I get excited because this is a part of the industry that I think has a profound impact on a consumer spending. But I also think our industry has done an absolutely terrible job of explaining how these parts and pieces work. If you go to, especially in America, if you chat with general consumers, just you bring up things like, oh yeah, you're going to be buying a new truck. Especially in America, we're pretty good at just having a fog of peripheral knowledge about things like engines, right? You got people who don't really know about the mechanical apparatus, but they can say, oh yeah, it's got like a V6. Oh, it's got a V8. Oh, I've got a little four cylinder, things like that. And I bring some of this stuff up, and I nerd out on some of the most geeky stuff, but I bring stuff like this up because if we could help bring a few more people, not a lot, I'm not even saying like to have that kind of cultural awareness of tech products, but if we could bring a few more people, they would be more apt to make better purchasing decisions for their needs. The people who buy the cheapest possible laptop that they can get, and then they're upset that it doesn't really do the job, but they're just viewing laptop as laptop as laptop. I mean, as part of the conversation that I got into with Jason, Painfully Honest Tech, and people were mad that I kept interrupting him, but we kept using words like comparable, but then he'd compare a $900 laptop against a $1,300 MacBook, and you're like, well, I feel you're giving Apple like a 30% price advantage. That's not comparable. I mean, you can compare them. They are comparable in the sense that you can take one thing and another and you can say this one's more expensive than that. But that's not what we mean when we say comparable products. And this is the kind of tech miseducation that has kind of swept across all of our products, tablets, smartphones, cameras, computers, laptops. It's so hard to kind of focus someone in on what are you doing with your tech and what would be the better fit for your tech. That was a long ramble. Because right now, one of the exciting arms races is literally in ARM styled chips, the SoC of choice for a lot of our phones and tablets, and some, increasingly some of our laptops. So I'm going to screen share this here real quick, and I'm going to get a quick drink of coffee before my voice kind of sort of fuzzes on me.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Mmm, savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Sorry, I'm trying to do a better job of muting whenever I'm slurping and clearing my sinuses. So, Huawei teardown shows chip breakthrough in blow to U.S. sanctions. Huawei Technologies... What is the abbreviation CO? Is that incorporated? That's not incorporated. That would be Inc. Huawei Technologies Corporation? Is that what it is? Anyway. And China's top chipmaker have built an advanced 7-nanometer processor to power its latest smartphone, a sign Beijing is making early progress in a nationwide push to circumvent U.S. efforts to contain its ascent. Huawei's Mate 60 Pro is powered by a new Kirin 9000S that was fabricated in China by Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, according to a teardown of the handset that Tech Insights conducted for Bloomberg News. The processor is the first to utilize SMIC's most advanced 7-nanometer technology and suggests the Chinese government is making some headway in attempts to build a domestic chip ecosystem, according to the research firm. Now, in the context of this article, it suggests that, oh, they're making some headway. This blew regulators away. This shocked the international community of people that have been watching the advancements in nodes, in fabrication. When pressed for other comments and other articles and what the expectations of the Chinese market were, it wasn't that long ago that we were blocking them from 14-nanometer chip fabrication and trying to keep that kind of hardware out of China. It has been a radically quick adjustment to see them move from process node to process node. Every time you make the chip smaller, when we measure these components in nanometers, every company kind of has a different estimation on what they're measuring. Intel was very critical of smartphone chips being called 10 nanometers or 5 nanometers because they measured transistors and gates in a different way than TSMC was measuring or Qualcomm was measuring for their process nodes. It's a very complicated, you would need someone like Dr. Ian Cutress to better explain why some claims were being made by some companies. I'm not qualified to give you that kind of information, but in the way that we've kind of all agreed on measuring chip size, node fabrication, blah, 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 we're now getting into 5 and 4 nanometer production for smartphones. The fact that SMIC was able to cut down to 7 nanometers this quickly is a very big surprise to international regulators, is a very big surprise to the tech community at large. And it would mean to me that their ability to adapt and to evolve these technologies is significantly more aggressive than what we were expecting. So when we start looking at the Mate 60 and people, oh, it's all 7 nanometers. If SMIC's design can improve on some of the thermal management over Samsung's fabrication process for the Snapdragon 888, which actually wouldn't be difficult given how thermally challenged the 888 and the last year's Snapdragon 8 Gen 1 were, this could be a phenomenal performer up against sort of the last generation of smartphone chips, even though it's coming at a die disadvantage in terms of size. It'd be going up against 5-nanometer parts for the most part in Android land. If they can improve on some of the thermal regulation, that's enough. That is a huge shot in the arm for Chinese manufacturing. It's kind of incredible to see what they've been able to accomplish. So all of this story, here, let me go back to the Bloomberg article because they mentioned the 14-nanometer fab. With its export controls last year, the U.S. administration tried to draw a line at preventing China from getting access to 14-nanometer chips, or about 8 years behind the most advanced technology. The U.S. had also blacklisted both Huawei and SMIC. Now China has demonstrated it can produce at least limited quantities of chips 5 years behind the cutting edge, inching closer to its objective of self-sufficiency in the critical area of semiconductors. So I take issue with that framing, saying that's 5 years behind. Oh, who would want to buy a phone that's 5 years behind? I don't believe that's accurate. We'll have to see what the performance testing on the Mate 60 Pro really resembles, what it really looks like using that phone. I would be shocked if it's far off from the era of Snapdragon 865s, 870s. So your Galaxy S20s or your LG V60s, I bet you we're probably playing in a ballpark like that. So we're really more like kind of 3 years behind in terms of practical performance per watt. Just because it's 5 years behind on the actual node process doesn't mean that other technologies haven't caught up. So if they've improved on radio management, if they've improved on thermal dissipation, if they've improved on memory management, if they've managed to evolve the chip at that size, you can find other power saving, you can find other performance improvements, you can find other efficiencies. The actual daily driver use, I would be shocked if this thing isn't nipping at the heels of phones from 2 years ago. And that's where I get real cranky, because I believe consumers have been grossly overbuying performance for the last 4 or 5 years. I would say at least since the Snapdragon 855. So what you can do on a phone, practical day-to-day, the Snapdragon 855 to me was the first truly laptop competitive, get your work done from your phone kind of chip. And it really showcased the benefits of things like desktop modes and video output and screen mirroring. That was, what, over 4 years ago, almost 5 years ago? Since then, people keep buying more and more powerful devices, often at the cost of battery life. I feel consumers would probably want better battery life, not, you know, 17% faster performance in file compression. I'm never going to be the guy to say, who could even use that much power on a phone? Because I am that guy. I want to use more power on my phone. But if you really ask consumers, there's a reason why hyper-exotic, super-fast sports cars are not the norm. Because people have, like, families they need to drive around, and fuel efficiency is a thing. And that's the same kind of metaphor we're lacking in smartphone land. There is no performance deficit from using a five-year-old mid-ranger chip. What really matters is that you've got batteries to support it, that you're optimizing the software, and mid-ranger phones from 5 and 6 years ago would be perfectly performant today if they still received that kind of attention and that kind of support. I digress. This is kind of an incredible development to see play out in real time, and to also see, like, governments are very interested in what's happening. Teardown videos, kind of incredible to see what these components and what the manufacturing on this look like. It is a very public arms race now. And this is happening at a time where ARM's about to IPO, right? They're about to go public. Some of the expectations on ARM going public, the expectations are kind of dropping a little bit. So investors are a little concerned about ARM's portfolio, because at the same time, ARM went and sued Qualcomm. I believe that's still a lawsuit that's kind of in open litigation, even though Qualcomm seems to be moving forward with their new ARM referenced cores. Their new custom cores that are not ARM reference designs. MediaTek is talking about their next generations of chips, which are probably more closely built on ARM reference design. Samsung is eventually going to be bringing back Exynos. I believe Galaxy next year is going to be back with Exynos and an AMD GPU. And in the periphery, in the background of all of this, RISC is starting to become a more viable option for low-power controllers, for things like TVs, IoT devices. This is becoming a very complicated space. So when we start talking about an SMIC chip versus a Qualcomm chip versus a media chip, a MediaTek chip versus a Google chip versus an Exynos, all of these little differences and cores and configurations, those things matter. And if you want to have a good sense of what is it that you're trying to do with the phone, what kind of power and performance are you looking for, and what kind of battery life are you hoping to get, it's the same kind of conversation that we have with engines. It's not enough to say, this is an octa-core processor, it has 8 cores. You've got to be able to kind of help a little bit more than that and say, well, this is a configuration that has more performance cores. When you really use the phone, you're going to get less battery life. Or this is a core configuration. It's a little slightly older design, but we know it's going to give you longer battery life. And if you pair that with a big battery, you're going to get days of runtime just scanning through some TikTok and keeping up with your messages. That's the kind of conversation we need to be able to condense for people. Otherwise, they're just going to go, oh, I just need it, just works. So I'm just going to go buy an iPhone. And that's actually not a good solution for a lot of people out there. Getting a screaming high-performance A-series processor, A-series SoC from Apple doesn't always deliver what you want. Like, someone wants an iPhone SE kind of communicator device, having that top-of-the-line chip with that smaller battery is not a good combination. So this, to me, just kind of, you can hear, I get really lit up about this. This is a really exciting arms race that's happening in the ARM chip market right now. I think this is going to have humongous implications for other devices too, from tablets, laptops. I'm starting to get press releases on mini desktops that use ARM processors, and maybe you want a Chrome desktop, or maybe you want Windows on ARM. All of these things are going to start impacting the consumer space in a way that I don't believe consumers are really ready to handle why this is different and why it works the way it does. So I'm going to kind of leave this article here, read through the Bloomberg assessment here. It is a really good look at kind of how the business has lined up with regulators jumping in and government saying, whoa, but I thought we stopped them. No, Dave Burns, this is exactly it. So Dave Burns writes, Apple Silicon. Apple took the Band-Aid off. So Apple Silicon as a part is one of the things that I am extremely excited to see as a disruption in the traditional CPU GPU market. On top of that, I have been using the crap out of my Robo Ancala. It's a Windows on ARM little slate. It's kind of a Surface Pro clone. It is not the most powerful machine that you can buy at that price. I mean, right now, I think it's on sale for like $899 with the keyboard blade. So it's more affordable than a mid-tier Surface Pro. But this is why it's so critical to look at those differences. Apple helped kick off a proof of concept. Apple laptops with Apple Silicon, Mac minis with Apple Silicon. I'm super excited at the performance of Apple Silicon. I'm not going to buy a Mac because I can't do things like upgrade the RAM. It's harder to upgrade the storage. Like all these things that Apple does to make their product kind of openly hostile to people like me who like kind of upgrading or sprucing up a machine after you own it for a year or two. So you get the Robo Ancala and you can't do things like upgrade the RAM. That's a part of the SoC. But you can do things like swap out the SSD. So this thing has a little 512 gig SSD in it. And at some point, I'm probably going to pop that out and put in a 2 terabyte drive just because I can. I mean, it's those types of things. Now you can look at a market and say, hey, there's an easy upgradability conversation to be had here. There are different parts and components, different expected use cases. There's still a flavor. And if we lose the flavor and just say, oh, but MacBook, then our industry is basically dead. And it's really sad to see that kind of conversation fade away. And it's kind of on people like us that nerd out on stuff like this to kind of bring a little of that interest back and say, like, no, this is kind of cool. Trust me, it is kind of cool. But hey, if you're into cars, this is kind of like having a turbocharged V8. This is kind of like having a lean, mean V6 in a Roadster. This is the machine that you want if you want the minivan. And that, I think, kind of gets, I'm speaking from a North American perspective where car culture is always on the brain. I feel like that kind of gets the point across. It's why I always turn to vehicles as my metaphor. Let me take a drink of water. I've been speed rambling here. Hold on 1 second. Vulgarity, completely correct. It sums up my argument for the Xperia 10 phones, 5,000 milliamp hour battery, and aren't they still on Snapdragon 695s? Is that what's in the Xperia 10? Or did they finally switch over to like a 720? I can't tell you. I still feel like the Pixel 5a, great camera, headphone jack, I think it had a 5,000 milliamp hour battery, 5G connectivity on a Snapdragon 765. That phone is still one of the all-time best real average consumer devices. Incredible point-and-shoot camera performance, multi-day battery life, just enough processing power to get you through some higher-level activities, shooting, editing, and rendering 4K video. Totally doable, not the fastest, but totally doable, and enough graphics performance for some moderate gaming. Xperia 10, it's like it's in that ballpark. All of these mid-ranger devices, much better consumer daily driver phones, but they don't get the same cachet. They get lopsided coverage. Techies love to watch videos about the most expensive devices. We don't cover the Galaxy A series, the Pixel A series, the Xperia 10s, the vast sea of Pocos and Realme's and Xiaomi's and Vivo's and iQOO's. But those are the real devices, the real bread and butter devices that people should be using more if we really believe in this idea of the average consumers. I completely agree, vulgarity. Absolutely spot on. I got to catch up with the chat. Oof. Ghoststar Scream, isn't the A Bionic and the M series from Apple from ARM, though? So, Apple is under a different licensing agreement than what many of the Qualcomm and MediaTek chips are under. This is a little deep in the weeds, and like I said, I'm not completely qualified to draw this out for you, but Apple has a specific licensing agreement where they are referencing ARM tech, but they're allowed to build their own CPU cores, GPU cores, their own configuration using some of ARM's materials. For a while, that's what all of the other semiconductor companies were doing. What was Samsung, I believe, their code name was Hummingbird. Qualcomm references Cryo cores. Google and Tensor is kind of another sort of gray area in there. But for a while, especially like around the Snapdragon 810, what Qualcomm was doing with custom cores wasn't as efficient as just the ARM reference design. And so especially with, I think, the Snapdragon 820 through like the 865, that kind of peak of TSMC manufacturing with Qualcomm core configurations and ARM reference designs was sort of that sort of best of all worlds manufacturing. So there are different relationships that you can have with ARM. And ARM puts out their own reference design. And one of the reasons why ARM was suing Qualcomm, I believe ARM is trying to make their benefits more known. So they're trying to lock down their licensing where if you're using their reference designs, you can only use their reference design. You can't use a different GPU or any custom coprocessors. If it's an ARM reference chip, it is completely an ARM reference chip. So Qualcomm bought out a company that was more like Apple. They bought out a company that had a looser licensing agreement just for some of ARM's technologies, but was developing custom cores. And they believed that that transferred, that the stuff that that company was working on, they should still be able to keep working on. ARM was arguing Qualcomm's current licensing agreement is for a reference design. They're not allowed to just absorb the previous contract. I am grossly oversimplifying 8 years of legal wrangling in the silicon industry. So apologies, but that's about as much as I could kind of understand what was happening. Hold on, I'm like I said, I'm way behind on the chat here. Oh, so Barry, thank you so much. So the Pixel 5a had a 4,680 milliamp hour battery with the efficient Snapdragon 765. So I was off by 10% there. I apologize. Yes, and the Xperia 10 is still on the Snapdragon 695. 695 is a great chip for that daily driver communicator experience. It loses out on some of the more fun stuff, and it's definitely not a great chip if you want to do more than like basic Candy Crush or solitaire style gaming. But the 695 is great when I need to take a couple photos and I need to keep up with my messages and I check my email and I scan through some TikToks. Like, it's brilliant for that kind of use. Let's see. Sorry, I'm catching up here. Yes, Dave Burns, that is also correct. Apple has a very old and very expensive version of the ARM license, and ARM is not engaging in the same kinds of relationships with new customers today. But Apple is Apple, so you know. So yes, this is another, I think, another good example of how this industry can kind of, these different parts matter. Dave Burns says, Qualcomm made up for their CPU design shortcomings with best-in-class modem and antenna matching, as well as amazing GPUs. And this isn't, again, it's why I kind of hold up the Snapdragon 855 as this like high point where we were at peak LTE. We were just starting to staple on some 5G to a couple of phones, like the V50. Had a 5G variant, but not all regions got it. You had to staple that on. And it really upset me when Qualcomm split the modem off entirely on the Snapdragon 865. Snapdragon 865 is an incredible performer for CPU and GPU performance. It was a poorer performer for radio performance, for LTE and 5G. And that, to me, was a very frustrating step in the wrong direction, which this then compounded on the Snapdragon 888 and the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1. So, moving right along, I do want to cover, this one's just kind of funny to me. Here, let me screen share this back up. This is coming by way of Financial Times, written up by Christina Criddle. Shorts risks cannibalizing core YouTube business, say senior staff. Senior staff at YouTube have expressed concerns that Shorts, the Alphabet-owned company's answer to short-form video app TikTok, risks cannibalizing its core business. Shorts has amassed more than 2 billion users since its launch in 2021, but has drawn away audiences from traditional longer videos on the platform, according to multiple people familiar with the figures. Oh no! YouTube pointed their algorithm and shoved short videos in everyone's face as a knee-jerk reaction to TikTok, and now people are watching fewer long-form videos that they don't know have published because the YouTube algorithm is shoving shorts in their face. I'm totally confuzzled. How could this be? How could it be if you, as a platform, get in between the audience and the creator so that they don't know what the other is doing, and you just keep shoving short-form videos in their face? Who would have thought that the longer form videos would suck? I can't. It's a shock. This is shocking. I am shocked. Shocked, I tell you. Shocked. Oh, Barry Johnson actually just beat me to it. Say it isn't so. Gormlord, I feel the same way. YouTube Shorts can eat my shorts. Dave Burns, oh no, YouTube is racing to the bottom and can't make as much ad revenue while also driving off their core user base to competitors like Dropout TV and Nebula. Oh no! I feel validated because I have been very cranky about airing my dirty laundry, but at the same time, this is exactly the kind of business development that we have been highlighting when we talk about things like creator burnout. Think of all the YouTube channels that have scaled way back or left completely and have stopped producing higher quality content. And then people complain that there isn't as much to do or to watch or to see. But everything YouTube has done over the last several years has been to interrupt the relationship between creator and audience. More recently, think about how much more difficult it is. You pull up YouTube on an app on your phone, which is now becoming sort of the de facto version of YouTube. As I watch my stats, my view stats kind of shift and morph. People are engaging with mobile more and more and more, and in part because of shorts. But even the basics, like getting into the information in the description, is now a very confusing process. Where do you tap on the screen to get information? And it slides. So now you've got like a little two-line description, and then you, but where are the comments? If you scroll down, you just see more videos. So you scroll back up, and I just want to leave a comment. And so then you swipe it over to the side, and it moves the description out of the way. It is so maddening how YouTube is destroying the relationship building and discovery process. And then they're complaining, oh, but now we're not making as much ad revenue. Oh, no. Let me take a quick drink of water here. So another reason I don't like, I said, I don't want to subvert the articles. I want you to go to Financial Times. Depending on how you get to the article, you might, it might like paywall you. Let me get this set up here. So I just want to show this off. One of the reasons why this is so precious to YouTube, these numbers are insane. So I'm going to screen share this from them. I don't love their little bar graphs, but I think it'll get the point across. The age profile of digital media platforms users varies dramatically. So this is monthly time spent with UK users as of June 2023. And these measurements are in billions of minutes. Billions of minutes. So, on YouTube, the demographic of 18 to 24-year-olds are spending roughly 8.6 billion minutes a month on YouTube. And then we see sort of a sliding scale down from 25 to 34, 35 to 44, 45 to 54. 45 to 50-year-olds are only spending 4.9 billion minutes on YouTube. But then, 55 and over, 7.6 billion minutes. Now, when you say 55 plus, I have to imagine that this is like a 30-year age demographic where all of these other age demographics are more like 8 to 10 years difference. So that's not really a fair combination, but anyone over the age of 55 is almost as likely to be spending as much time on YouTube as 25 to 34-year-olds. By comparison, on Facebook, 18 to 25-year-olds spend 0.5 billion minutes a month on Facebook. So again, 8.6 billion minutes a month for 18 to 24-year-olds on YouTube, 0.5 billion minutes a month on Facebook. And in the UK, Instagram is not that heavy a hitter. We've got 0.7 billion minutes a month, 1.7 billion minutes a month for 25 to 34-year-olds. In comparison, TikTok is now garnering 3.1 billion minutes per month in that 18 to 24-year-old demographic. This is a big deal because later on in the article, they show the change in UK viewers. And TikTok has grown substantially on 18 to 24-year-olds and 25 to 34-year-olds. But YouTube has lost significant time watch on those two age groups. So over, what is it, from June 2019 to June 2023. So over a four-year period, 18 to 24-year-olds watched 1.7 billion fewer minutes. So currently, what was YouTube at? 8.6 billion. At one point, they were over 10 billion minutes a month on YouTube. Now that's shrunk by almost 2 billion minutes per month, while TikTok is up 2.8 billion minutes per month. So you can see YouTube is heavily reacting to this change from TikTok. And that's why shorts are becoming such a precious addition to their lineup. But the only demographic that has grown over the last 4 years is over the age of 55. Every other demographic on YouTube has shrunk. Every single time you just knee-jerk react to the market and you copy a competitor, you validate why the competitor was right and they're going to leave your service. Every time Samsung makes the Galaxy more like an iPhone, people are going to buy more iPhones. Every time Instagram, YouTube, any other social media platform copies TikTok, it just makes TikTok more powerful. I need to get in a boardroom and line up all of the CEOs of all of these companies. TikTok and Apple, they can sit down. And then I just need to run with my arm extended like anime style and just stooge slap every one of those other CEOs in a row. You are not providing value. You are interrupting the relationship between creators and audiences. You're making this toxic AF. It is a huge blow to creators' mental health. You're constantly reinforcing all of the red down arrows that you're just not performing like you used to. It's just not good enough. And it has nothing to do with the creator. Has nothing to do with the people creating the content. This is a systemic problem with the platform. And it is leading to the erosion of YouTube as this idea of an institution. Now, YouTube still garners the lion's share of content distribution online. But I feel a lot of people are starting to look at YouTube like I do. YouTube is not a place for good discovery. It's not a place to find fun recommendations and to find new content, discover new trends. And it's basically just a big, dumb storage block. As far as I'm concerned, the only benefit to YouTube for me right now is free server hosting. If I had to host all of my own videos on my own platform, that would be really expensive. So I'm glad that YouTube is fronting the bill because there's no other benefit for someone like me with YouTube. It's free and that's it. It's all it's ever going to be. Anything else, I've got to draw every audience member to watch and find and discover my videos. YouTube doesn't really help with that to any grand degree. And it's only when something really controversial happens that YouTube considers my video of any benefit. And literally, like, the video that's hitting the hardest right now is me complaining about the YouTube homepage. And a bunch of people had their homepages turned off. And so now a bunch of people are finding my video. YouTube did not facilitate that viewership. YouTube got in the way of my subscriber audience. And instead, a bunch of other people were searching for, like, why is my homepage totally blank now? And I just happened to have a video out on that, and that's why that video took off. YouTube is digging their own grave, and I don't think there's any way that we'll see them really kind of dig out of the perception of their company right now. I do not see any leadership at Google, at YouTube, or at Alphabet that inspires confidence in their current strategies at the top. And it's so disappointing to know all of the amazing people that work at Google, work at YouTube, work at Alphabet, and I just lit up like 5 phones on my desk right now, all of the incredible talent that they have suffering under visionless executive leadership. And we can see the numbers change in real time with every terrible decision that they make.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people. Producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hello, my name is Martin, and I run the Tech Altar YouTube channel. I talk about tech, obviously, but instead of focusing purely on the devices themselves, I mostly analyze the companies, their business and marketing strategies, as well as the industry trends that shape the gadgets we all love. I studied business, I worked for a couple of tech companies like Oppo in China, for example, and I'm building my own tech startup on the side right now, so I really like talking about these topics. And if you enjoy zooming out and trying to see the bigger picture as well, you can find me by searching for Tech Altar, that's A-L-T-A-R, on YouTube, and you can also come say hi to me on Twitter as well. Thanks, Juan.
Fat Brooders, I think TikTok made me realize I'm an old man. It's the platform all the kids are into. Dave Burns, the burnout will continue until morale improves. YouTube 2023. Vulgarity. Oh, God. The provide value mantra. It's so rough. I mean, it really is. YouTube, one of eight ads loading from JG Wright. Or Jay Great. I'm sorry, I probably mispronounced your name there. I appreciate y'all having a laugh with me, because like, you got to laugh to keep from crying. We've got two articles here that I just kind of want to step on together. One from Engadget, written up by Lawrence Bonk, and another from Ars Technica, written up by Ashley Bellinger. At some point, I think we need to call it. At some point, I think we need to say the Musk experiment with Twitter, now X, has been an abject failure, and there aren't enough stern warnings to course correct for a site that has been sort of destroyed. What the core mission of what Twitter was as a microblogging service, it has been dead since Elon Musk took over the site. And every permutation of this site gets worse and worse and worse. And I think it is insufficient to have a bunch of regulators sternly wag their fingers at Twitter and say, hey, you better ship up, and this time we mean it. And then another week goes by with yet another scandal and yet another problem, and then the regulators come back, oh no, you did another oopsie, and now you've got to fix it. So I want to start off with the least bad issue from Twitter. So if you're concerned about like online digital privacy and content creation and all that fun stuff, Elon Musk's X will use public data to train AI models. The artist formerly known as Twitter has been in some hot water this week after Bloomberg found the social media site would start collecting biometric details along with job and education data from users. Now, a newly released privacy policy indicates that X will use this data along with other collected personal information to train AI models, as originally spotted by Alex Ivanovs at Stack Diary. The privacy policy clearly indicates that the company plans to use information it collects along with any publicly available data to help train machine learning algorithms. Quote, we may use the information we collect and publicly available information to help train our machine learning or artificial intelligence models for the purposes outlined in this policy. And Musk has confirmed those changes. So whenever we see this kind of stuff go up on other sites, people flip out and there's like a protest and then users leave the platform. I like this because every single time a story like this comes up, the people who are more privacy-minded, a little techier, a little geekier, end up on every other social media platform that I've enjoyed using. And this is yet another surge in Mastodon users. I know I keep prattling on about this, but no algorithm standing on your neck, no algorithmic sorting of content, no interruption between you and your audience. Feeds are chronological, and you can catch up to your feed and go, okay, well, now I've read all these stories and I'm done with Mastodon, and that's fine. And every single time I cross-post across Blue Sky, Mastodon, Threads, and Twitter, I get actual human engagement on Mastodon. Grounded Tech just shared a lovely collection of flower photos on Mastodon. Barry Johnson was out there sharing some stuff on Mastodon. TK Bay shared some of his Nando photos, the whole Sony event thing. That was awesome. Those were all on Mastodon. And if you've been following me on Twitter and you see like, oh, Juan hasn't posted a whole lot, one, the Twitter algorithm isn't showing you what I am posting, and two, I've been posting more over on Mastodon. So the follow-up to this is, if this wasn't bad enough, you're concerned about AI, you don't like how businesses can just steal content and profit from it, it has huge ramifications for copyright and for distribution and for media. The other fun part of all of this is the political side. This is from Ars Technica exclusive. X violated its own policy by blocking First Amendment groups' ads. The ads were blocked in error, according to X. And this is from Ars Technica. X, formerly known as Twitter, spent the summer hastily rebranding and vying to win advertisers back, but at least one advertiser was shocked when X swiftly rejected its ads after deciding to return to X. A nonpartisan nonprofit, the Freedom Forum, told Ars that last week it discovered that its X ads were being arbitrarily blocked after attempting to advertise an educational family-friendly festival that celebrates the First Amendment. The group assumed the ads were blocked in error, so it reached out to X six different times, and at various times, X rationale for blocking the ad changed. At first, X's automated messaging told Freedom Forum that the ad violated X's political content policy. That policy restricts ads that reference legislation. But Freedom Forum said educating the public about their First Amendment rights shouldn't be considered referencing legislation. I want everyone to go through and read just the hilarity of how bad X's stance on all of this was. And I love it because we get to the end of this and they're feigning this. Oh, it's just a mistake. Oopsie. It was an oopsie. We did an oopsie poopsie. And that's okay. No, you know, our bad. When that group reached out six different times and this issue wasn't really corrected until it hit more news traffic, I call BS. I say that is not a simple error in a system on a platform. That is a continued disruption of what the service is there to provide, targeting a very specific entity. And that should be the F illegal. That should have regulators swarming over X. That should have fines being levied. We should be talking also about class action lawsuits. This should be a substantial penalty for not participating in an earnest fashion on a large public entity like Twitter. And we've been seeing these types of issues play out time and time and time again. Twitter was running a list of sites that ostensibly kind of just fell into the bucket of Elon Musk does not like them. And they would slow down your ability to click on a link and get to an article from a list of sites. They were targeting these types of communications while supporting alt-right, authoritarian, fascist, literally paying people to be Nazis on the platform. That should be illegal. The entire structure of Twitter Blue, that should be illegal. You pay Twitter and you might earn the ability to make money on your tweets if they get popular enough, but Twitter controls the algorithm for how your tweets become popular. So if Twitter controls how your posts are seen, and you're paying Twitter for better views on your posts, and then Twitter can come up with a metric to say if your posts get really popular, we'll pay you. That's a multi-level marketing scheme. That should be flipping illegal. And yet every single time one of these, we've got to give them a warning. We've got to make sure that they fly right. You know, they've got to straighten up. We've got to give, like, at what point do we declare that they are not earnest participants in this conversation? They are acting now as disruptors, slinging FUD, slinging misinformation, weaponizing disinformation. And at what point do we also say, like, Google and Apple are complicit? Because Google and Apple will make money on any microtransactions that happen or subscription fees that happen through the apps. So Google and Apple are like, oh, you better not do this. You better make this better. But they're also profiting from the system that Twitter has created to interact with phones and tablets and computers. So at what point does this entire thing just have to be shut down? I believe we've gotten to the point where Twitter needs to have the plug pulled until they can demonstrate that they are able to conduct behavior and manage a platform in a responsible fashion. To this point, they have not demonstrated that capability. Everything on Twitter has gotten worse since Musk took over. Everything in regards to interactions between different people, how your content or feed is managed and optimized and algorithmically sorted, privacy concerns, AI media concerns. I'm going to go through and I guess I've got to start deleting tweets and stuff because I'd rather not have my years of Twitter interactions be fodder for an AI. That is a significant kick in my rear to have to go through and self-manage that stuff. I'm not going to pay Twitter to have my tweets seen a little bit better and to get a few extra perks and benefits. Things that you get for free on Mastodon, you have to pay for on Twitter. And you have none of the same sorting, organizing, or discovery tools now because everything has to go through Twitter's black box. This is getting ridiculous. It's getting really bad. And at some point, we also have to ask people, why are you still hosting and supporting content? I know why. The reason why is you've got the momentum of having had followers on Twitter. But you know what you're supporting. And at some point, you have to ask, why are you okay with that? So I've massively curtailed my use of Twitter outside of just a few contractual obligations that I have with other content that I'm producing. And I'm going to be starting that slow pull of anything that I put on Twitter. And then also, I'm not going through and just deleting my account because I also want to go through and kind of disrupt what content was on my account and go through and start downloading everything that I had on Twitter and nuking everything that I had on Twitter. And it's, I mean, my eye is twitching just thinking about the amount of time and effort it takes to handle things like social media. And it's pretty disgusting. From JG Wright, Juan talks about Twitter misbehaving. YouTube looks around nervously. Oh, yeah, Dave Burns, I love this. To be fair, Muskie Poo did fire all the QA and community management folks because they weren't generating value or whatever. It's so bad. And then I also have to throw another womp. Jman150 gifting a tier one sub to Sveticus. This is awesome. Jman150 Fat Produce, thank you for all the gifted subs. Thank you for all the support. This is incredible. And I really do appreciate it. I missed a hype train. I got to the end of ranting about something in housekeeping, and apparently there was a hype train on Twitch. And so we had a little choo-choo emoji that I did get to share. But I just thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. These are exactly the kinds of conversations that I feel are critical to our hobby. I mean, this is like my way of life. I've been in deep on mobile tech since I played with my mom's, you know, HP scientific calculator as a little kid. The ability to pick up something and have it contribute to your daily life in a meaningful fashion is really the only conversation I've been interested in my whole life. So I always appreciate being able to hang out with some other nerds that kind of, I mean, more than just like, oh, I use it to get stuff done, that you're actually entertained and interested and you have fun with this stuff because it is what it is. So let me get this out of the way. This is great from Kenox. Again, just another shout out to a brilliant YouTube channel that you should be following. I watched Legal Eagle talk about Twitter trying to block a government subpoena because Elon wanted kudos with Trump. They definitely seem to be doing things wrong lately. I saw that video too. I cannot recommend Legal Eagle enough to help frame some of the conversations that we have in this space. I know people love to kind of march around and say, oh, but I don't want politics in my things. Everything is politics. Every part of your waking life is politics. Every business decision that you make, every grocery store decision that you make, everything you do is influenced or contributes to politics. Everything. So if you want to be a functional contributing member to society and you don't want someone else's boot on your neck, you need to at least be aware of how politics are going to screw you, how politics are going to mess with you. You cannot live in modern society and evade politics. It is an omnipresent presence. Yeah, that kind of made sense. I'm using words and I'm trying to sound clever. I think you know where I'm going with all this, though. In your video games, everything is politics. How you monetize the game, politics. The content in the game are discussions. If you like comic books, guess what? Politics. All comic books are political. You can have Frank Miller, you know, boasting a heavy right-wing agenda in your politics comic books, and you can have X-Men boasting a heavy left-wing agenda in your politics, in your comic books, all politics. Politics. If you don't care a little bit about this stuff, other people do, and other people love that you are trying to ignore what they're doing in the realm of politics. That's my last little soapbox, whiny Dave Burns. Wait, are you saying V for Vendetta has a political agenda? Yes, they are trying to do politics at you, and you might not have noticed with all of the cool action sequences and badassery, but it's politics. It sneaks up on you. It's pretty insidious. So, That last little bit, and again, for thanking everybody who's supporting me soapbox and ramble on about this stuff. We're to now the part of this where we would be talking about gadgets and the gadget block. I am still sad because of politics. I'm no longer really supporting or contributing over on Reddit. I just feel like they killed what made my me interested in Reddit. I'm dabbling with Lemmy. Lemmy is sort of another one of these Mastodon federated open source ideas for creating a different kind of Reddit style social news. And it's okay. I'm kind of slow getting into Lemmy. There are fewer people over there and all of the instances are spread out and kind of disorganized in a way that I think Lemmy is more difficult to get into than Mastodon was for replacing Twitter. Mastodon was up and running for me, and I was off and interacting with other people, and it very quickly replaced my Twitter experience with Mastodon. Lemmy is not proving to be the same kind of accessibility and ease of use and ease of entry as Mastodon was for Twitter. So I'm kind of playing around with some of that stuff. I still haven't found a way that I feel I can revive the old subreddit, Glowing Rectangles. But I would still like to talk about that, just as the mission is all of your favorite content creators need help sharing and promoting and finding audience for their content. And that's a user. That's a user challenge. Every platform is trying to walk away from good support for creators because anything we make is just disposable content. So, IFA is happening, and there were a lot of really interesting announcements. One of the ones that we talked about a little bit was the Lenovo Legion. So Lenovo came out with their own handheld Switch meets Steam Deck style gaming portable. So it's a little mini PC, and it had detachable controllers, just like Joy-Cons for a Nintendo Switch. I also showed that they had a pair of glasses. And I thought this was very interesting. So Lenovo released a pair of AR glasses called the Glasses T1, I believe they were called. And let me get that out of the way there. Okay, sorry. So the Glasses T1, and as near as I can tell, with just a minor refresh, this isn't a radical new glasses design. With a little minor refresh, they've taken the Glasses T1 and they're now calling them the Lenovo Legion glasses. Well, Lenovo is a really big name in tech manufacturing, in consumer electronics. So now that Lenovo has made a pair of face display glasses, well, now this idea is really interesting. Now, you know, hey, look, CNET has an article. Lenovo Legion glasses are wearable gaming display. You can play games on these things, guys. Have you seen the games? Look, these are glasses and you can play games on them. And look, here's the Lenovo Legion and you plug the glasses into the Lenovo Legion. And isn't that so interesting? And then, well, oh man, right on top of that, we've got Tom's Guide and Lenovo Legion glasses hands-on. Finally, AR gaming I can get behind. You know, we haven't had anything to get behind. AR and gaming, you just, boy, there's just nothing to support in that space. Now we can really get behind this idea. Now has legs. This is a real thing now, people. Lenovo put out these glasses. You can really do it now. Oh, man. So, I'm a big fan of face displays. Since 2020, we've been seeing these products come out. Let me, I've got my Rokids over here. My X-Reels are downstairs because I use these things a lot. So these are the Rokids. And I just want to highlight why I get a little pissy with other tech commentators. This is a little bit of a knock, and I don't mean to be this pissy, like Tom's Guide. I peruse Tom's Guide. I'm not really trying to slam him on this, but it just goes hand in hand with how terrible our influences are with things like search engines. So if a small company does something really exciting and disruptive, consumers aren't searching for that small company's name. They don't know the small company exists. So tech commentators and reviewers ignore the small company because they know they're not going to get a lot of traffic on any in-depth coverage, reviews, hands-ons, videos, because the algorithms aren't going to point people to content that is already less popular. If a lot of people are searching for the name of that company, you can put the name of that company into the title of your headline or the title of your article or your video, and more people will find that article or video because of the name of the company. So, Lenovo has these Legion glasses. And I think they look okay. Little 1080p micro OLEDs. Oh, wait, let me go to the other article because that had that picture. There we go. Little 1080p micro OLEDs. I hate this cable design. This cable design looks like it came directly out of the first generation TCLs. And so the cable looks like it scoops into the glasses frame in a way where that boot might, how the flex on the cable might wear out the cable over time. So that's a design that TCL gave up on, that Rokid never used, and that X-Reel never used, because it makes more sense to get a pair of glasses and then just over the ear, you plug in a little USB-C cable there. And then if anything happens to the most fragile part of that connector, you throw away that cable and you get a new cable and you plug it right back in. But Lenovo is getting all of this press and a bunch of journalists are coming out like, hey, I'm trying these things out and they're kind of, isn't it kind of cool? You put the glasses on your face and you see a giant version of a TV. Isn't that awesome? 2020. This tech has been functional and has been practical since the end of 2020. I got to test drive the TCL Nextwear in 2021. Took it on a road trip, and then I also used it just around my house during like some of the scariest times of the pandemic, you know, sort of into the second year of the pandemic. And we were just starting to try and do things like maybe we can drive to New Mexico. New Mexico is a pretty empty city. There won't be a lot of people to bump into. And so I'm showing people these experiences back in the end of 2020 and the beginning of 2021. And every time you put them on someone's face, there is a reaction. People have never seen anything like this before. But I hold tech reviewers and tech journalists to a slightly higher standard. And I shouldn't, but I do. So we reference these things like, oh, someone used the X-Reel glasses with their Steam Deck. And I guess that kind of worked. But now Lenovo has made some glasses. So now it matters because we can keyword a much more popular search term. Way more people are going to look for Lenovo things than X-Reel things. So now we can make more money talking about these glasses. I got to say, I have not tried them. So this is just by looking at the spec sheet, and normally I would condemn what I'm about to do. But I have been very passionate about my Rokids and very passionate about my X-Reels in the light of so many other techies saying, no, but they're sort of dumb. Like that letter that I got, or not letter, that comment that I got that I turned into a mailbag post. Oh, you shouldn't call these things AR glasses. You're a huckster. You're a fraud. Well, now Lenovo's doing it, and people seem to think that's kind of nifty. So these are the Rokids. The Rokids are going to be more expensive than the Lenovo Legion glasses, and probably by around $100 to $150, depending on region, distribution, blah, 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 blah. The Rokids have a wider field of view. So it's the same resolution, but on the Rokids, it's spread out, filling more of your view. So depending on what your needs are, the Lenovo Legion might be better for your needs. It's going to be a smaller field of view. It's going to occupy less of your vision, but it's going to be the same resolution in a smaller space that might help with text, with clarity, fine details, things like that. But if you're talking about a slightly more immersive experience, then the Rokids are going to give you that wider field of view. The Rokids are going to be more expensive, but they also have built-in diopters. So you can fine-tune, if you're nearsighted, you can fine-tune the experience without having to add lens inserts so that you can better focus on the content that's being projected out in space in front of you. And both of these are going to have options for people who wear glasses that you can put lens inserts for seeing out through the glasses. That's kind of a wash. But then the biggies, they're both 1080p glasses, but the Lenovo Legion are going to top out at 60 hertz, whereas the Rokids can crank to 120 hertz. So depending on what you connect these to, you can get even higher frame rate qualities out of the Rokids than you can out of the Lenovo Legions. So we're talking about headsets for gamers. It might matter to a gamer that it's not just Lenovo Legion on the side. Oh, Legion, that's the gaming brand for Lenovo. That must be for the gamers. But gamers care about things like high refresh rate displays and being able to game at 120 hertz and being able to take like an HDMI cable easily, plug this into a USB-C port, pop it into a gaming laptop or a gaming desktop, and maximize the frame rate on these in a way that they wouldn't be able to do on the Lenovo Legion glasses. So I'm positive. I'm really excited to see a bigger player release something in this space. Lenovo is a very big player in consumer electronics, and they've been at the, they're a tip of the spear company when it comes to things like modular computing systems, flipping foldable displays, hybrid tablet laptops, and they've been playing with AR in a number of different flavors for a while now. It's only a good thing that Lenovo will be able to shine some light on this consumer space. But the options that are out there from TCL, from Rokid, and from Xreal, so far I kind of think like they're all better than what Lenovo has put out. I need to get a pair on my face. I need to try them. I'm only talking from the announcements and the tech specs. That's the worst way to kind of armchair review a product. But they don't look better. And they look like they're making some of the early mistakes that I feel TCL made back when these glasses were like $700 or $800. Now, the most expensive options are just under $500. The Xreals are just under $400. And I think Lenovo's aiming for like $299, I believe. So we'll have to see how all of this stuff kind of aligns and fits together. But I just like, this is what kills me about the state of our tech industry right now. So many people have been kind of shrugging these off. And I've been trying to tell folks, like, until you get a pair on your face, you really don't know what they're like. And it's kind of cool. I mean, this is something fresh. Oh, but it's not ready, and it's not real AR, and it's too expensive, and it doesn't do enough. And you're like, no. If you get a really nice portable monitor, that can be between $200 and $400, depending on OLED and resolution and refresh rate and all that fun stuff. So if you add, I mean, it's a premium. This is a premium over a portable monitor, but you add about $100 and what you get is a portable monitor that can easily, you know, kind of just wear on a shirt or fit in a shirt pocket. You know, you can carry it very simply. This is your container. If you really want to protect it, you've got like a little sunglasses case that you can fit them in. And then on top of that, now they're offering even higher refresh rates. They're offering sensors in the glasses that can do some basic 3-degree head tracking. And if you combine that with the right computing platform, you can create virtual monitors that float in space out in front of you. You can't do that with a portable display. If I take a portable display, like I've got one right here, I've got to carry something that's basically as big as like another laptop in my bag, as compared to like a little pair of glasses that can fit in an easier case to handle and to manage. I can't use this on an airplane and connect it to another phone or a tablet or a computer. If you look at little tray tables on airplanes now, this is now not useful. And it really only becomes useful when I know I'm going to be sitting in one place for long enough that it's worth the effort to take this out of my bag and set it up. Like I go to like a coffee shop and I'm going to be there for hours, then I can use this. These I can pop in for very brief interactions and very brief situations, and I can use them in very space-constrained ways and get an even bigger display than what I can get with this. And we're talking OLEDs, 1080p, same resolution. This is handy. This is proving to already bring a benefit. And that's what has been so galling and so frustrating. So when I wrote that reply to the guy who called me a huckster or a fraud, it was one of the reasons why I kind of felt I needed to reply to that. I believe these are already bringing a tangible benefit today. You plug them into a game console, you plug them into a laptop, plug them into a phone. They are already delivering an advantage over the portable displays that we've used in the past. And then there's some tech potential that you could do more with them in the future. So TCL, not a big enough company to warrant that kind of coverage. X-Real, I mean, that's cool if you like to tinker and you're a nerd, but I mean, like average consumers. Rokid, kind of the same deal. Yeah, I mean, we love seeing that it's got high refresh and you could do some better things. And the speakers got way better and way bassier. But, you know, I don't think anyone's really going to go for these. Not until Apple shows us that they can make AR. And now Lenovo. Hey, these are AR glasses I can finally get behind. I review tech products for a living. And these are glasses I can get behind. I can back what Lenovo is doing, because they're doing something in this space that other manufacturers I would not have supported. And I feel that's kind of crap.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
Yeah, JJ, TCL is a TV company. Like, the company that makes displays, you would think, yeah, they probably make some pretty good face displays. Yeah, cup of cash. I am not fashionable at all. The glasses fit nicely in your cargo shorts. Accurate. Yeah. Oh, Gormlord, I've been subscribed to Tom's Guide since I was a teen, but I can't help but roll my eyes at the super clickbait emails I get from them. So I'm picking on some of these folks because, like, they really haven't given any of this stuff a shot. And I find that to be disappointing. I feel like one of the criteria of a, one of the criteria of a tech reviewer that I would like to follow is an active curiosity in what's going on in the tech scene. And far too often, you bring up these things that are on the peripherals of the mainstream tech audience, and you get these shrugs. And it's unfortunately because they know they can invest a lot of time and effort and energy and learn about this stuff, but it's not going to make them any money. It's not going to bring in the clicks. It's not going to bring in the views. And it has nothing to do with the viability of the tech. It has everything to do with the conversation around search and the conversation around algorithms. So then a Lenovo steps into this space and we can finally take this seriously. Apple shows off a $3,500 mixed reality headset and it's a shot in the arm to VR, even though it hasn't actually even shipped to anyone yet. And this is really the corrupting factor of how platforms have ratcheted control away from the content creators and the reviewers and the editorialists and the journalists. Now you have to weigh in the back of your mind, do I want to spend time covering this tech? Because if I do, I know I'm not going to make more money on it. Let me tell you, these videos don't do a lot of traffic. And the best way to get them to do traffic is to play games. Like there's a video out there, I think it's about the X-Reel, where it's like the Apple AR glasses demo video. And if you go to YouTube and you search for Apple AR glasses demo or something like that, you're going to get a decade of videos talking about how Apple's going to make AR glasses. But you're going to find a few videos featuring X-Reel and Rokid. Apple has nothing to do with this space. This wearable, slim, sleek frame face display kind of product, Apple has no toe. And Apple actively makes a lot of their products hostile to those kinds of accessories. But you're going to have YouTubers and commenters. Oh, I wish, I need Apple to make this. That's literally the title of a headline that you're going to find. Because they put Apple in the title of the video, it's going to do better, they will make more money. And that grossly misrepresents the influence that Apple has on the market and what these competitors are capable of. And it just continues to reinforce the idea that you should wait until Apple makes the product for real. This was a fun little thing to play with, but you should wait. Wait until Apple does it for real. Then it's a product you can get behind. Then it's a product you can really support. And all this time, people could have been playing with this stuff now. Since the end of 2020 and the beginning of 2021, these face displays have been practical examples of augmenting your reality. And that's the other thing that I think needs a huge course correct for education. You say augmented reality, and a lot of folks, especially techies, are going to start whinging on about fully realized location and spatial aware cyborg, Iron Man, Terminator, RoboCop vision, where everything is detailed and recognized and data connected and maps are graphed out in real space and my turn-by-turn directions are painted onto the road in front of me. That is the most science fiction realized concept of augmented reality. And that's what, like, Microsoft HoloLens is trying to do. Where, like, you can hold up your hand and it's going to build digital things around your hand and you can turn it into a Mega Man blaster and shoot bugs that are crawling out of your wall from other dimensions. And yeah, that can happen in a massive headset that you wear on your skull. That, I mean, that's real. We can do it today. The HoloLens 2 is an incredibly capable, real, fully realized 6 degrees of head tracking, location and GPS and data aware kind of a headset. But that's like the peak of AR capabilities. There's a whole spectrum, and anything that augments your reality is AR. And for me, I draw the line at AR with, I am looking through lenses, but I'm seeing the real world in front of me. as long as I can see the real world just through a piece of glass, then I believe that we are talking about some kind of AR solution. These glasses are the simplest form of a practical AR. A heads-up display is practical augmented reality. So it doesn't do anything fancy with the environment. It doesn't track and move things around or, like, you know, RoboCop in on someone and give you detailed information about them through a data connection. That, none of that. But I get a text message and it pops up and it says, hey, you got a message from your mom. That was information that augmented my reality. A little floating window that gives me turn-by-turn directions. It's not painting it out in full graphics all in the street in front of me, but it's still information that is augmenting my reality. My reality is not really getting stepped on. I'm still able to look and see and interact with everything around me. From the simplest heads-up display to the fully realized Iron Man vision, that entire spectrum of products is augmented reality. When I say mixed reality, what you're doing more is you're using cameras to feed the real world into your vision. And that is a layer of separation between you and the world around you. So the Apple Vision Pro is not augmented reality, it's mixed reality. So I think it's a little easier when you get a video feed coming in to then take that image data and paint other graphics into that as a digital signal of the video coming in from cameras. It's a little easier to lock things in space and move around them. It's more virtual reality. Mixed reality is that spread between AR and VR. And also people will brand XR in that space as well. So that to me is that conversation. And it makes me sad because for like 3 years now, we've had the ability to play with face displays. The earliest versions of this were the old Sony Cinema headsets. So they looked like big, bulky VR headsets. But this was before Oculus really started like taking off. But you would put this giant helmet on, and it was all these multiple cables to like plug into a TV or some type of media streaming device. And you could sit back and you would see the representation of like your video feed out in space in front of you, like you were sitting in your own private movie theater. The concept had, a lot of positive reactions. And I got to demo one, I got to try one. It was awesome. It really felt like you were just sitting in your own movie theater. It was a really kind of a unique experience for its time. This was a long time ago. That headset cost like over $1,000 with everything attached to it, and you had to run it from some type of computer device that was probably also a little expensive for its time. But you could do that, and then you could also do 3D. Because there are 3D TVs were kind of like starting to become this thing again. It was really cool. There was no way you were going to pack that, take it on an airplane, take it to a hotel room. Like, this was like an appliance for your home. Now, you can do something like pop a pair of glasses in your carry-on bag, sit back comfortably on your airplane in your airplane seat, and instead of rolling up to play your games and look down at your game station with your elbows like hurting because of the terrible armrests on airplanes, you can kick back, you can point your head up, you can move, you can play that and see this humongous screen out in space in front of you in the most comfortable way that you can fit. That is augmenting your reality by adding a giant projector where a projector did not exist. But you can also still see the flight attendant that walks by and asks you if you would like a beverage. See, that's a nice perk. Yeah, Dave Burns, you can miss me with 3D TVs too. So anyway, apparently, AR glasses are a thing now, folks, so get out there and check them out, because they're real, and we can support them now. I want to wrap up as we get into kind of the last 20 minutes of the podcast here. Sony Xperia 5. Who wants to talk about Sony's little mini phone? I've pulled up the specs here on GSM Arena. I do not have one, and that is part of the concern I have with Sony's strategy this year. We've got a cute little 6.1-inch but very, very narrow screen device. So this is roughly coming in a smaller width than a phone like a Galaxy S10e. But a 1080p, 120 hertz refresh rate, OLED, HDR10 support, also boasting the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2. It's getting the new main camera sensor from the Xperia 1 Mark V. That is a very exciting camera sensor to play with, but it is losing the telephoto. So everything else seems like it's stayed. 5,000 milliamp hour battery, we've got wireless charging. Everything that we liked in the addition on the Xperia 5 Mark IV looks like it's staying here on the Xperia 5 Mark V, but instead of adding... So this is, okay, I hate Sony names. I think it's funny when techies act like it's impossible to talk about Sony products. It's fair to criticize Sony products, but you don't like, oh, but how do you even say Xperia 1 Mark III and it's so hard? When I ramble these out, this is going to turn into word mush for your ear. So I'm just pointing this out. This is complicated. Xperia 5 Mark III had the same telephoto camera as the Xperia 1 Mark III. Xperia 5 Mark IV had a different limited telephoto compared against the Xperia 1 Mark IV, and now the Xperia 5 Mark V has no telephoto camera, where the Xperia 1 Mark V has that really beautiful zooming optics. Like, it is an actual zooming telephoto camera lens and housing. So, my hypothesis is, you go from the 1 Mark III, they had the extra space, they put in the two-stage telephoto. The 1 Mark IV, they changed up the body and the frame, they added more of the technology, like wireless charging. Was, I think, the first time it arrived in an Xperia 5 was on the Xperia 5 Mark IV. Someone please correct me, I might have that wrong. And then adding an even bigger main camera sensor sort of eats up the remaining space that you would have had with the smaller camera sensor on the 5 Mark IV. And also, when you move up to a larger main camera sensor, it makes your crop zoom even nicer. So I think the Xperia 5 Mark IV had like a 3x telephoto. But if you crop zoom from this new main camera sensor between 2 and 3x zoom, you're pretty close to the performance of a smaller telephoto camera sensor. You just can't go beyond it. So the advantage for the Xperia 5 Mark IV was crop zooming beyond the natural focal length of that lens. And now the Xperia 5 Mark V, the crop zoom is going to be really good from 2 to 3x zoom, but then once you push it beyond that, that's where I think your image is going to start to degrade even faster. Whew. I'm not as upset about losing the telephoto on a phone that is trying to sell at around this $1,000 price point, features every other new Sony technology, is using the most expensive SoC on the market today. I believe it's going to come in 128 and 256 gig variants, but still has memory card expansion, still has a headphone jack, still has those great Sony front-firing speakers, has a really good display. I mean, everything on this is looking like it's going to be solid competition against Galaxy S23 Plus, or this is confusing, but it's sort of in that space between an iPhone 14 and an iPhone 14 Pro. Like, it's too expensive to really say the comparison against is against an iPhone 14 unless you bump up the storage. But it's got some capabilities on it that give it features and performance that would nip at the heels of the iPhone 14 Pro. Like, again, 4K video recording at 120 frames per second. That is something that an iPhone 14 Pro cannot do. And I still point to that as the most beautiful slow motion footage that you can create from a mobile device. And it makes your family videos look ridiculously stylistic. Lex is running through a zoo and playing, splashing in water fountains. And it's so incredibly crisp at a data rate that would shame most other phones. And it's in this gorgeous slow motion that could be edited directly on the device. You didn't have to take it to a desktop to get that job done. It is really lovely shooting with 4K 120. also the improved selfie camera and some of those other features. So I'm very positive on the phone. I feel like there's a small bummer in losing the telephoto camera, and everything else is the same or better. I think Sony has learned some of their lesson from last year's phones, the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1, where those phones ran really hot because of Samsung, and then they built their phones to better handle thermals, and then they got a better chip, a better performance per watt chip this year out of Qualcomm and TSMC. So I think this thing looks like a banger. Like the Xperia 5 Mark 5 looks like a phenomenal mini performer in the premium space. And it's like one of the last small premium phones. Like you kind of have a Galaxy S23 sort of in there, I guess. Then you have your Zenfone 9 and Zenfone 10, though Asus is making us a little nervous with some of their recent staff cutbacks and some of the departments that they've shrunk and some of the rumors that they might be closing up shop on their phones. They've said they're not, but none of their internal structure is giving us a lot of confidence that this is a high priority for Asus moving forward. And then it's Sony. And that's it. So no notch, no hole punch on the screen, stereo speakers, headphone jack, memory card slot, 4K 120 video, the ability to easily pop in and use the Sony as an external monitor for your camera. Now you can record directly onto the phones using that kind of a setup. Everything about this is pretty spot on. So I'm excited to see it. It just makes me a little anxious now. Sony didn't reach out to a lot of us medium-sized and smaller American content creators. So like me, TK Bay, guys like us. Often when we're seeing the North American launch of a product like this, we're looped in as North America is being considered. So for the Xperia 1, I was able to play with a prototype because they were confident they were launching the phone in the United States. We would just be the last to get it. The actual retail version of the phone, North America was the last place to send it to. You fulfill your demand in Japan and China, then you ship the phone to the EU, and then you send it to the United States when your manufacturing has kind of covered the places where the phone is going to sell the best. The last time we played with this where there was no direct shipping announcement or expected delivery announcement for North America was with the Xperia 5 Mark III. The Xperia 5 Mark III actually shipped to the United States the year after, in January of the year after it was announced. And in that same year, we also got the Xperia 1 Mark IV. So you had Xperia 5 Mark IV. So you had the 5 Mark III in January and then the 5 Mark IV later that fall. It was not a great combo. But now we're playing a similar nebulous game on when or if it'll ship to North America. And that makes me very anxious. This is the phone I wanted to get for my wife. This is the phone that my uncle wanted. I've mentioned my uncle in previous podcasts. He's currently using a Galaxy S9. He does not want a big phone. He wants a phone that can still handle a huge memory card. He loves having all of his media and content and stuff on the device. He doesn't want to have to spend like over $1,000 to get a phone with more built-in storage. And he wants it to be a nice phone. I mean, he was a successful dude. He wants to be able to like own something pretty and own something nice. And so I said, hey, just keep an eye out on this. Sony makes some cool gear. They're still shipping to the United States. And now we don't know if it'll show up here or when it might arrive or if Sony is going to pull the plug. So it might end up being only the Xperia 1 gets sent to the United States. And that would break my heart because we've already lost the mid-ranger. We've already lost the Xperia 10s. This was a great twofer, having a more mainstream sort of... it's not a cheap phone. We're still talking $1,000 here, but it was a little bit more accessible. And then the Xperia 1 was like, hey, all the bells and whistles, the peak of Sony technology, the incredible display, the slightly larger form factor. That, to me, was a winning combo. And it's really going to make me sad if we lose that two-tier option. So, JJ, what was the price of the Xperia 5 Mark V? Right now, it's rumored to... I mean, not rumored. It's around 1,000 euro. But, of course, all of this changes with distribution, regions, taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, it's from JG Wright. Thank you, Sony, for making a phone I would buy. I'm a 1 Mark II user. I still have my Xperia 1 Mark II. This, to me, was like the main turning point in Sony's strategy, bringing back the headphone jack. This phone, I mean, like, I still hold on to it and cherish it. It's just a brilliant phone. Marie has my Xperia 1 Mark IV, and I don't think I'm getting that phone back. So if Sony does not ship an Xperia 5 Mark V to the United States, I think my Xperia 1 Mark IV will forever be lost to my wife. Holding on to that device. So that's pretty great. JJ, I don't know what you mean. Do people want to pay MSRP? I don't think anyone ever wants to pay MSRP. We always talk about like sales and deals and things like that. But I always rank phones by MSRP. I feel like that's the fairest oranges to oranges comparison, is to say the manufacturer claimed the phone was worth this much. That's what it should be compared against from other manufacturers. Yeah, Random Hobby. This is a good fight. The battle between the Xperia 5 and the Zenfone is hard now. I don't know which to choose. I was waiting for the 5 to come out. And yeah, it's the same. Like, if we can't get this in a reasonable time frame, or we at least don't get an update to know how long we should wait if someone wanted to buy an Xperia 5, I'm gonna start pointing my wife or my uncle, maybe you should check out a Zenfone. And it sucks, but if you got a Zenfone with 512 gigs of built-in storage, you would still save about $100 over the Xperia 5 Mark V. So it's not ideal for someone who still wants a memory card slot, but that kind of works. That could kind of work out. I'd love to be able to pop in a 1 terabyte card. Can't do it. Drives me nuts. Random Hobby, 1,000 euros is a little outside my price range. I think 1,000 euros should be outside of almost everybody's price range. I published an article on somegadgetguy.com talking about heads up display glasses and AR glasses, and techies talk about these things like, well, you just use them with a really expensive phone. What's the problem? I don't see why you need to have like a little mini computer that can power the display or add the AR tracking or anything like that. You just use them with an expensive phone. So I did the math on how many phones really, as a fraction of the yearly sales of smartphones every year, how many people want to guess how many phones are sold? Let's make this simple. Over 2022, what percentage of phones were sold that could make use of these AR glasses? You could just plug them directly in, see an image, and then you could also add like the head tracking capabilities through an app on your phone. What percentage of phones sold? And I bet you anyone who guesses that answer right probably read my article. But I want to see how. Leave a message in the comments. How many hit that? JG Wright, less than 50% is a good guess. But I want you to think about every manufacturer that makes a smartphone or a series of smartphones, makes a premium smartphone, makes a smartphone that has features that can do things like output video, and just how many do we think? Dave Burns is saying 12%. JJ is saying 5%. Let's see if anyone can get close without going over. Onscon read my article. Awesome Possum, I didn't read it, but I'm guessing less than 15%. Gormlord, whatever Samsung sells, pretty much, at least for the U.S. That's not true, Gormlord. You're way off. Malika's saying 5. So those of you saying 5%, you were close. You didn't go over. Onscon read my article. 7%. Of phones sold in 2022 are capable of using AR glasses without extra accessories, battery packs, connectors, adapters, or any other kind of equipment to facilitate. You plug in the cable, you see an image, and you can do some of the basic AR head tracking, 7%. And that's me being generous with some of my assumptions on the market. And for Gormlord, you're saying like, oh, well, whatever Samsung sells must be doing it. But remember, only Galaxy S phones have video output, and only the Z Fold has had video output. So years of the Z Flip didn't count. Only now the newest Z Flip even has video output to be able to use something like this. Apple devices cannot power these headsets without adapters and battery packs. And Xiaomi devices, so the third place manufacturer by brand name, only one phone in the history of premium Xiaomi devices has finally added video output, and that's the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I have my Xiaomi 12S Ultra. This was I bought this for $1,300, $1,200. No video output. USB 2 on this premium ultra tier device. Only one phone in their entire lineup currently being sold with video output. So when techies talk about like, oh, what premium phones and blah, 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 I believe they're buying their own BS because like this stuff is way more limited than you think it is. Yeah, JJ, 0% of that low percentage are mid-rangers. Now, if we were talking about the year 2020, then you would have had the LG Velvet. And do you remember all of the tech reviewers who said the LG Velvet wasn't really good enough? You should buy like a Galaxy A series instead, or you should get a Galaxy S on sale. The Velvet is too expensive, even though it was less than the price of a Galaxy A70. It's too thick in the dual screen case, even though in the dual screen case, it had more surface area for both screens and a higher resolution at a better pixel pitch than the Galaxy Z Fold. And it was thinner than the hinge on the Galaxy Z Fold. But it was the Velvet dual display, too big. No one could use that. It's too thick. It's too big and it's too thick. And that phone had a headphone jack and memory card expansion and a really nice 1080p display. And it had video output and it had a desktop mode. Had LG Screen Plus, which was almost as good as DeX. And that's, to date, the last mid-ranger that could have used all of these features. Before that, I think it would have been the BlackBerry Key 2. BlackBerry Key 2 had a mid-ranger SoC, but BlackBerry supported video output through the USB-C because a business person might want to or need to run a presentation from Microsoft PowerPoint on their phone, and they could set it up and you would send out an alternate video of just the presentation and you would click through your slides on the phone and you could set that up. The BlackBerry Key 2, I think, was one of the only other mid-ranger SoC devices that has had this kind of video output. And again, look at all of the people who are like, oh, it's not good enough. You need to make it better. You just make it like a Samsung. And then I would like it, but I wouldn't buy it because the Samsung has the Samsung on the label. And that's what I care about, is that I'm buying a Samsung. So yeah, that's where we're going to wrap this up. Me doing my dopey tech guy voice. Yeah, Key 2, I really miss. You know what? I've got the Key 2 in red. I should pop it back out, throw my SIM card in it just for a little nostalgia piece. Because like, I've played with some of the Unihertz and stuff like that, but they're just not the same. And that Key 2 was such a brilliant communicator. It, like a good camera, the screen is miserable for gaming, but like, man, you just want to like, just get through your messages and deal with your emails and then have all of these keyboard shortcuts to like call people and launch apps. And it's just such a, sorry, I'll save that for a future video. Yeah. JJ, RIP BlackBerry. It kills me. We had something really special there. And Dave Burns always wrapping it up, being salty about LG. I love it. Lampros, is it time for a match of Jay Estrus? We should plan another just like gaming day. I'm gonna set it up on the Patreon. We have not done a game night in a while, and I would like to just do something silly, like break out some Jaxbox games and just get goofy, and maybe I'll pour myself a double bourbon and you guys can make fun of me or something like that. And I think that would be a lot of fun. So stay tuned on that. I'm gonna put out a message on the Patreon about setting up a game night. And I need to make these more regular because it was really fun just jamming some Tetris. So, folks, let me get this over the way here. Everybody, Again, especially folks in the United States, I hope you're having a lovely and wonderful holiday weekend, Labor Day weekend, and remember those who gave some pretty terrible sacrifices for you to enjoy the benefits and the lifestyle that we all have today. And for everybody around the rest of the world who isn't celebrating the United States Labor Day, you probably have been impacted by it slightly on how we put out content and how people take time off. I hope you're just having an awesome start to your week. This is the beginning of the week. We've got so much tech news coming up. We've got the last announcements from IFA that we get to check out. We're right on the heels of Techtober as companies are starting to rumor and leak all of the new gadgets that are going to be coming in the second half of the year. It's back to school. Kids are getting to play with new gadgets. Grown-ups are getting to kind of launch into new computers and laptops and tablets. It's really a good time. This is a really fun time that we get to sort of play with all of this next phase stuff. And we get to look at the year ahead and the year to come. So folks, I hope you're having an amazing start to your week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. I'll catch you all back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.